From the Sky News Centre at 5. The number of people killed by Hurricane Matthew in Haiti has jumped to almost 600. A state of emergency has been declared in Florida, Georgia and the Carolinas as the storm makes its way north. Claire Nullis is from the United Nations Weather Agency. She says the storm's destructive force could continue for a while yet.
Matthew is a very big and a very bad beast, and it's not going to go away in the next couple of days.
UKIP MEP involved in an altercation with leadership favourite Stephen Wolfe has denied he punched him. Mike Hookham admits he and his colleague had a scuffle in the European Parliament in Strasbourg, but insists Mr Wolfe started what he calls the silly tussle, which was over in moments.
There was no punches thrown, there was no blows thrown, there was no slap faces, there was no pushing. Quite silly, quite embarrassing. Handbags at dawn, it lasted seconds.
Stephen Wolfe's being kept in hospital for observation. Both he and Mike Hookham face an investigation by UKIP. Jeremy Corbyn's appointed John Ashworth as the new Shadow Health Secretary. He's one of the few remaining moderates in the Shadow Cabinet, and his promotion will be seen as an olive branch. The Labour leader had been accused of abandoning plans to reunite the party after sacking Chief Whip Rosie Winterton and appointing his allies to key frontbench positions. A former chief executive of a mental health trust will get a £190,000 settlement package after leaving her job. Katrina Percy quit her previous role at Southern NHS Foundation Trust, which was criticised over its failure to investigate hundreds of deaths. The Chancellor says the government will be able to recoup all the money it used to bail out Lloyds during the financial crisis by selling off its remaining shares. They're worth around £3.6 billion. And Craig David, Laura Umvula and Tiny Temple will perform at this year's Mobos. The event, now in its 21st year, will take place in Glasgow next month. That's the latest standing.
Yes, folks, it's Friday, thank God. 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling helping me review this week's news. It's Labour councillor for Hartcliffe, and with you with Mark Brain. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, we take a close look again at Syria as the United States pulls out of talks with Russia. The US is withdrawing cooperation from the Russians over so-called ceasefire violations. So, as the US and Russia come closer to open war, we look at the air war in Syria. How would it pan out? Whose radars are best? And whose surface-to-air missiles? Is this war being used as a proving ground for a potential World War III? Also, drugs trade and the Central Intelligence Agency. We have an interview with the journalist who passed away nearly 10 years ago, Gary Webb. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the other world's hotspots. If you can think of any, that's in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius and a few showers. This weekend, highs of 16, mainly cloudy tomorrow, but some sunny spells on Sunday afternoon. Next week, highs again round about 16 Celsius, sunny spells all week pretty much. Next weekend, 15th and 16th of October, highs of only 11. It's getting cool, isn't it? And sunny spells though next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Labour councillor for Hartcliffe, and with you with Mark Brain. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
First of all, Mark, you've been on the council for how long now?
13 and a bit years.
And what brought you into politics?
I used to work in a print company called Arrowsmith, which was on Widstoke Road. There's a storage thing there now. And there was an industrial dispute, which went on for a year and a half, and I was on the picket line all that time. And during that time, I thought, you know, I should perhaps become a little bit more involved in politics. And I saw which parties helped me and which ones didn't. And I joined the Labour Party.
So what happened with that dispute eventually? I mean, you know, a lot of people... What year are we talking about?
God, 93.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Bristol used to do a lot of printing in the old days, not quite so much now.
Yeah, I mean, they were primarily a typesetting company rather than a print company anyway. They mainly did scientific journals and things like that.
But anyway, what about the dispute? What happened?
The company closed. They wanted to... They wanted to de-unionise was basically it, and
well, it's probably your fault, was it?
I was one of the first people to qualify to be dismissed along with the rest of the workforce. Yeah, yeah.
But you mean, you know, did you not think to yourself, well, maybe this wasn't such a good idea to go on strike if we've made the company go broke?
Well, you've got to stand up for your rights, haven't you?
Well, even in the face of having no job at all,
Didn't think that far ahead. To be honest with you. We thought it would end amicably in the end. If I'd owned the company, I was trying to, and I was trying to de-unionise it myself. What I would have done is, because they were hoping about half the people would accept the non-union contract and go back to work, and only six did, and I would have myself said, okay, it didn't work. I'll get them all back in. I'll give in for a bit. I'll prepare. I'll go at them again in a couple of years' time. If I was in their shoes, that's what I would have done. But they didn't. They dug their heels in, and the whole place is closed now.
Well, it sounds to me like you're part of the almost the DNA of the demise of a lot of industry in the city.
Yeah,
I mean, it was a big.
You.
It wasn't well, not necessarily pointing the finger at you, because maybe the company would have gone down anyway. I would suggest to you it may have been that that the board were looking at de-unionising because they could see their accounts were going down and down, and this was a.
It wasn't really a board as such. It was one woman that owned the place.
Right, okay. Yeah. And so was she looking at de-unionising because she was possibly going to go under anyway?
I'm not sure. At that time, I wasn't financially literate, so I don't know how their finances were. But they would by now, they would have done, definitely, because, I mean, you know, when I designed my local Labour Party leaflets, I can do on my laptop what they used to have these massive computers to do, you know, and people had to take on apprenticeships to be able to do that work. So,
okay, well, now you're financially literate.
Yeah.
What's going on at the City Council? 1,000 job cuts?
Yeah.
Is this really necessary?
Yeah.
Well, tell me why.
Because the council has overspent. We had a briefing on this August, and the new S151 officer told us that at that stage they thought it was £29 million, but it could well be more because they were still looking under the rocks. It would seem since they've looked under the rocks, they found a few million pounds more. The greatest.
So where are these rocks? Are they along the gorge somewhere? Or?
Yeah,
little tunnels in the gorge.
I suspect they're more on paper and on computer hard drives and servers and the like. So the previous council officers had led us to believe that their business change program was going to make all these savings, and they made some of them. But they really had no plans for the rest, and it was something that Marvin inherited. I don't blame George Ferguson for that, I would say, because George is not a finance man. I doubt if he knew it happened.
Well, is Marvin a finance man?
No, I don't think so. But Craig's taking on the role.
He was on here last week.
Yeah, and. But a difficult job. I'm glad it's not me that has to
do it. Well, one of the things which we were looking at the city accounts, and anyone can do this, just go online and have a look, the last lot of accounts, the reserves have gone up by about £150 million over the last year. Some people saying that a lot of this is going towards pensions, but it can't all be going
towards pensions. No, the pension fund's separate. The pension fund is run by Bath and North East Somerset Council. Bristol doesn't run its own pension fund at all. So, because when Avon demised, basically that's what happened. The four councils, North Somerset, South Gloss and Bristol and Baines, basically gave it to Baines to run. So Bristol gets one vote out of about 12, I think, on that board, something like that. I'm not saying they've done a bad job, they're not, but Bristol doesn't
so
run.
So this Section 151 officer, maybe we should try and persuade them to come in and explain some of this.
Yeah.
Who?
Sorry, the name's gone. Sorry.
Okay, but okay. So it sounds to me as if we really need to try and. I mean, we will on this show. We're on a mission really to get to the bottom of some of these figures because I think to a large extent. I mean, I don't know if you would admit to this, but you know, you see these large balance sheets go by, and to a large extent, we're having to trust what the city council officers are telling us.
Well, the councillors in the same position. I mean, you mentioned the reserve just now, and I didn't really sort of cover that, so I will talk about that.
Sure.
The reserves, like we said, not for pensions. They are, in fact, for major projects. I mean, the council's going to have to build a lot of secondary schools because there was a population increase going back about 10 years ago. And so the primary schools filled up and we needed new ones. And now these children are going to hit secondary school soon. So we're going to need secondary schools. Even though Bristol doesn't run any secondary schools, we're still responsible for education. So there's that. Some reserves are what they call unallocated reserves. That's to say it's, you might call it rainy day money, it's flooded city money, it's what happens if a plane falls out of the sky onto a housing estate money, it's major disaster money. So there's some of that, and you need quite a bit of money for that. But the bulk of it is allocated to projects already. The question is, are these projects that we need to continue or not? Because although you can't take reserves and use them not to have redundancies, it don't work. Because you can spend it once, that's it. It's not revenue. But what you can do, if you decide you don't need a capital project, you can take it off the books. And then in future budgets, there won't be any revenue cost to maintaining the loan that you took out build the project.
So how much do you think we can pinch from this pot? What's your rough estimate?
I don't know. They're working on a plan right now, aren't they? And as I understand it, it comes out next week. So we'll see what Craig and Marvin and the rest of the cabinet have come up with.
Well, one of the things they are doing next week, so they've said, is they're launching this kind of, well, they're asking us, what do we want to keep and what do we not want to keep? Now, that seems to be, in a way, their job. You know, that's what we've elected them to do, is to say, well, actually, we think these things are the important things. Rather than just to say to us, this is now over to you guys.
Yeah, but they're asking people what they want. I think that's a good thing, really. I mean, the days of councillors sitting in the council house and deciding what's good for people and I think are pretty much over. There are more consultations. There used to be a Conservative councillor for Bishopsworth called Ron Hodges. He's passed away now. And he did say that a consult was a cross between a con and an insult. And, you know, so many consultations, let's face it, in the past they have been, half-hearted or even predetermined, but he's asking people what they want, and I think that's fine.
One of the things that might be pushed back potentially is the Bristol Arena, isn't it? We've been hearing this week in the Bristol Post, City has repeatedly missed out. I mean, this is where they start it, because the Bristol Post basically puts the view of the great and good of the elite of the city that think this is very important that we have this. Well, maybe not a lot of people would say it is, but I mean, if it isn't commercially viable, why isn't the commercial sector doing it? The city has repeatedly missed out, it says, on a major arena, and as a result nearly fails to attract the biggest acts and shows. Well, whether that's part of the city council's job to do that is another question. And rather than sacking 1,000 people, it was despite repeated efforts, it's failed to deliver a suitable venue down the years. So in his address this week, Bristol's Mayor Marvin Rees appeared to suggest the £90 million venue, which is due to be built on derelict land, may not open for business till 2019. Now, is that, you know, I would have thought it was going to be a few years being built anyway, so surely this isn't really any much of a change here.
Building an arena is not an alternative to getting rid of 1,000 people, but actually they're not being sacked. These are going to be voluntary redundancies. But nonetheless, they will be job losses. But it's not one's not an opposite of the other. If we didn't build the arena, it doesn't mean that the job losses wouldn't happen. That's not the case. It would just mean the arena wouldn't be built. Why it's delayed, I don't know the details, because I only heard this today. Really,
yeah. Well, isn't there quite a lot of city council money going into this arena?
Yes, but an awful lot of money that's going into it isn't ours as well.
Yeah, so, I mean, surely if...
Putting the land up, I think, is basically, from memory, because it's been a while since I've looked at this, from memory, we're putting the land up. So it's our land.
Yeah, so it's going to happen, but not until 2019, apparently, it won't open. Yeah. I mean, I would have thought, I don't think that's actually really news much at all, as it was going to be happening anyhow by 2019.
Well, I think I'll get used.
Tell us a bit about your portfolio on the council.
What I don't have one.
Committees? committees? You're not on the cabinet, no. What was committees you
said? Oh, I see, yeah. Until recently, I used to sit on Business Change Scrutiny Commission, and I used to chair audit, which I don't do now. I've now moved over to the People Scrutiny Commission, which I've only been doing for a few months. It's incredibly complicated, and I can't even say it. It's incredibly complicated, and I'm still learning, because although I've been around the council for a long time, this is all brand new territory to me. Quite interesting.
But chairing audit, that sounds like quite an important job, actually, because the problems nationally and internationally have been that the auditors haven't really effectively been doing their jobs. You know, we're talking about people like RBS's auditors and Lloyd's. I mean, they're in the news again today, aren't they, that Philip Hammond is ditching the retail sale of taxpayers' Lloyd's bank stake, and £3.6 billion worth of shares are being sold off.
Yeah, and when I once met somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody who was on the audit committee of Northern Rock, and he was a chartered accountant, this fella, and the week before it collapsed, he had no idea it was going to happen. And that can happen.
But that is, if he's on the audit committee of Northern Rock, that means the auditors have pulled the wool over his eyes, doesn't it?
Well, you get two lots of auditors in any case. There's internal and external auditors. So there's the internal auditors in the council's internal audit department, and they go around making sure systems work.
Are they council officers then?
Or? They are. Yeah? Yes, they are. And it's their job to make sure systems work, so that you're not paying the same bill twice, or bills, you know, it's all about management of risk, not elimination of risk. That's important.
Right? That's impossible.
It's impossible. That's why it's important to say it's not about elimination of risk. There will always be risk. Stuff will always go wrong. But it's about the reduction, the management of risk. Then there's the external auditors, which used to be the audit commission, and now it's not. They went to Grant Thornton, who are an audit company, an accountancy company, and it's a company called BDL now. Yeah.
But, I mean, surely the Audit Commission is far better to do that rather than one of these commercial, one of the big four, perhaps, even.
No, they don't exist. They can't do it. They don't exist anymore. The Tories abolished them.
Who?
The Audit Commission.
Right, I know. But so who's going to do... I mean, we've got people like KPMG, PricewaterhouseCoopers.
Yeah.
These big guys, they are as much in the crookery, surely, as the bankers. I mean, I'm not asking you to agree with that, but no, if you look at their audit... if you look at the audit that they did of the banks in the run-up to 2008, it just was not fit for purpose, was it?
Yeah, but I don't think we got a bad deal from Grant Thornton, certainly. BDL I can't talk about because they just came in last year, and I've not had much dealings with them. But Grant Thornton, I always thought, did a fairly good job for us. A person can't see everything, but, you know, I had a...
Do you trust auditors?
Yeah.
Pretty much?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, trust ours. I can't talk about Lloyd's Bank's auditors. I don't know anything about them. But I trust ours. Certainly in internal auditors. And here's the important thing, because the council has an audit committee, and the chair is now my friend, Ollie Mead. And...
Yes, I've been trying to get hold of Ollie, actually, in the last...
Okay, yeah, you should get him on, because he's great.
Come on, Ollie, on you come.
yeah, you'll have a good time when Ollie comes on. So it's the important part. There are two women who do the job of chief internal auditor, and they have it as part of their contract. They can't be dismissed or disciplined without the say so of the chair of the audit committee, so that senior council officers can't intimidate them. And that's a hugely important protection, because I mean, right now I think we've got some good senior officers coming in.
Do you think we've got better protection at Bristol City Council than, say, in a big commercial business? Then,
don't know. No. Honestly, I don't know. One can imagine a situation where a large accounting firm was auditing a large bank, and, you know, all sorts of things could happen. I think at the council, it's pretty clean, yeah.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, I'm going to bring you in on this news today about Lloyd's. I mean, it might sound like a stuffy, boring old subject, auditing, but actually, it's really important. It's about all the cash we are forced to pay, and if we don't pay it, we go to jail. Then where does it go? Well, It's a big mystery, and the auditors are trying to explain what it is. But today, we've been hearing about this retail sale of taxpayers' Lloyds Bank stake. It is history, and they're going to start selling off shares again. At least they're going to try to, and they say it's £3.6 billion worth.
And I'm not familiar with this story. So they're selling off. They're going to they've cancelled the sale, or they're going to go ahead with the sale.
No, just read the headline out. Philip Hammond ditches retail sale of taxpayers' Lloyds Bank stake, and they're resuming a share sell off. So I think it's a bit by bit sell off rather than a lump sum.
So, in other words, I mean, they were talking at one stage. We had Stephen Williams on here some while ago when he was an MP, and he was saying that when we come to reprivatise the banks, perhaps we should give the shares to ordinary people. And
that's right. Well, this would be a bit like go tell Sid or ask Sid or whatever, you know, like BT selling them off, trying to sell these shares cheaply to the public.
So, in other words, the idea is that the public will get cheap shares if they subscribe.
Well, that
to
was
it.
The idea. Now they've decided they're not going to do that. So, sorry to.
So they're in theory going. In other words, for
the Guardian is saying
value rather than.
Well, the Guardian is saying Philip Hammond drops plan to sell cut price Lloyds shares to the public. So they're now.
Oh, in other words, they're going back to what you might. They're going to try and sell it off to somebody who's actually got some money to pay for it.
Yeah, which wasn't really working.
Yeah, well, they might not. I mean, don't forget, we're probably going to lose money on it either way. They're selling it to the city now rather than to individual shareholders, but it's likely that they're selling it for less than it's actually worth. Because, in other words, the banks that we nationalised, the share prices have never reached what they were when we paid for them.
So they're selling for less than they paid for it in the first place, you're right.
Exactly. So, in other words, we're going to lose money on it.
Yeah.
Looking at the wider picture with the sort of economy. More a bit more globally, and I mean, well, I'll say globally, I mean in the UK, not just here in Bristol. There's a really disturbing article which I reread again this week. It's called the Daily Telegraph by Philip Aldrich, who was then their economics editor. Government urged to reveal the true national debt of $4.8 trillion. The Institute of Economic Affairs calculated the national debt is $4.8 trillion. No sense, it's not in there, folks. I've just got it here in front of me.
Oh, okay.
It calculated the national debt is $4.8 trillion once state and public sector pension liabilities are included. £78,000 for every person in the UK. The IEA raised its concerns after the latest public finances from the Office of National Statistics. Now, what they're essentially saying here, Mark, and sorry to just bowl this at you, totally out of the blue.
Yeah, thanks.
Is that effectively the real national debt is about four times what we're being told it is. We're being told now it's around about 1.7 trillion. The true figure is more like 6.5 trillion because they're not including the state pension liabilities, or there's another thing they're not including. The national debt, the state pension and, oh gosh, something else anyway, but some of these large public sector liabilities, I know, yeah, state pensions and public sector pensions are not included at all in that figure of the national debt, which surely they should be, shouldn't they?
I'm not sure. I honestly can't express a view on that one because it's beyond my area of knowledge.
Martin, what do you make of it? I mean, this is something that the government knows it's going to have to pay at some point in the future. Mm-hmm. It's effectively taken the money to. It has, hasn't it?
I've come to a decision.
Go on then.
Yeah, no, it shouldn't include it because it's not a debt. It's a future liability. It's a different thing.
Okay, what's the difference? Explain it.
It's
something you've got to pay back in the future. Sure,
but that's not a debt, is it? Debt's something you've borrowed. So the national debt is something that's been borrowed. So the idea of sticking on pension liability as a debt, I think that would be inaccurate. The Treasury should have a plan or an idea of how it's going to pay that liability when it comes. So it's still money they've got to fork out, but it's a question of headings. I don't think it's the right heading to put it under debt.
Another similar sort of story. UK's four biggest banks, £155 billion short of safety, warned so-called experts. This is Ben Chu in The Independent. The UK banks had to be rescued in 2008 and 2009 at huge cost to the British taxpayers. But they would need to raise another £155 billion in fresh capital to withstand a new financial crisis. Now, we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, Martin. One of the, I think it was from one of the think tanks, anyway, was saying that they thought there was quite possible there'd be another financial crisis any time soon because the banks hadn't prepared themselves. What's your verdict?
Well, I think the chance of another financial crisis is definitely there. Anybody who says otherwise is
a bailout.
Well, the question is, how can you bail them out? I mean, Deutsche Bank collapses, which everybody's been talking about over the last few weeks. Their derivatives book is several times the GDP of the European Union.
But look, Deutsche Bank are playing games here, aren't they? I don't know what, if you want to contribute on this, feel free, Mark. But, I mean, we had this bit, we were talking about this last Friday, that Deutsche Bank have been fined 14 billion, right, by the US for mis-selling PPI over it in the US and various other misdemeanors. Then they say, oh, looks like we might have to collapse.
In the LIBOR
and actually, what's been happening since is there's been these high-level negotiations over in the States. The Americans are now saying, well, maybe we can reduce the fine down to 5.5 billion.
Well, that was a rumor, actually, because there's been no negotiation. It looks like
there have been negotiations.
No, somebody put the rumour around that they were going to get a reduction, and on that basis the share price rose, and that was a ramp by somebody in the stock market, because then the Americans said, well, we've not had any negotiations about this and we've not agreed to reduce it. Also, of course, you've got to remember that Apple have just been charged 15 billion, I think it is, by the European Commission.
Well, they will take that to court, won't they?
Well be that the slapping down of Deutsche Bank is a retaliation for the attempt to get the back tax off Apple. And don't forget, also, the French and the Germans look as if they're going to scupper the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership. So what we're dealing with here is economic warfare, basically, between the EU and the US. And underlying all of that is the fact that the banking system is insolvent. We've wasted 3 years, 4 years talking about Brexit. What we should have been talking about all along is that the banking system is insolvent. We're back on the quantitative easing. That's why the economy looks as if it's okay. That was supposed to be a temporary measure for a few months in 2008. And here we are in 2016.
Worth remembering, the Germans said they'd never do it, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, a collapse by Deutsche Bank would certainly trigger a financial crisis. There's no doubt about that. It's massive. It's not just in Germany. We all know that. The thing is this. You were talking about this on last week's show, and it's been talked about before then. Now, that's a couple of weeks. My view is, if it was going to go down, it would have gone down a lot faster than this. That's just my, you know, I just take the view that these things happen quite suddenly, and there's been a lot of warning, and I suspect. Put it this way, I think there's probably things we don't know.
Well, there certainly are things we don't know. Yeah. There are known unknowns and unknown knowns and all the rest of it. But I think it's absolutely clear that the banking system in general is systematically insolvent. It's kept going through quantitative easing, through zero interest rates, which of course clobbers savers, clobbers pension funds and so on. The measures that have been adopted, the unconventional financial measures that have been adopted, have given a completely delusionary picture of what's going on.
Well, okay, another delusion.
You can carry on printing money and having Martin, interest rates for a long time.
Another delusion.
What you've done, right, and
for many people, a more important delusion is your idea that it's going to be another crash. Many people will say, no, that's just nonsense. Well, and one of those people, hang on, is a certain Philip Hammond, who's the new Chancellor of the Exchequer, and we may have not noticed, but there's been a Conservative Party conference this week. So let's have a listen to a little clip from Philip Hammond's speech.
Having been Shadow Chief Secretary for 3 years, up to the 2010 general election, I rather suspect that infamous note by Liam Byrne, you remember the one, "Dear Chief Secretary, I'm afraid there is no money," I rather suspect that note was intended for me. But it went to David Laws, who published it, although I read he's now trying to get it back. And of course, it became what may be the shortest political suicide note in history. Liam, your message to your successor was an admission of Labour's abject failure. Yeah. I'll let you into a secret. My predecessor didn't leave me a note. But if he had, here's what it would have said. Dear Chancellor, employment is up. Wages are rising. The deficit is down, and income tax has been cut for tens of millions of people. That is the Conservative record. That's the difference a Conservative leader makes.
Mark?
Well, it makes you want to stand up and cheer, doesn't it? Well, no, not really. Yeah, it's nice for him to go back 6 years to the first Tory government, and their great fiscal conservatism was supposed to eliminate the deficit by the last election, and then it didn't happen, and then it was going to be by the next general election, and already they came to realise that, you know, it's not going to happen, and it's because austerity just doesn't work. Some people don't like austerity because it's cruel. Some people don't like it because of the cuts to their services. But also, it doesn't work. And we can see it doesn't work because the more they practice austerity, the worse it gets. And so the Tories have replaced the person who's running their austerity program with someone who says, do you know what? I think we ought to invest. Yes, they ought to invest. Yes. We've mentioned this once or twice in the last 6 years.
And also then the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, went on to talk about what he thought was the fact that the Conservative Party is the only party that's really got the credibility to manage the economy.
Tough early choices and the doggedness in sticking with them delivered that intangible but indispensable commodity, credibility. Credibility in the markets that helped secure record low borrowing costs, and credibility with business, securing the investment that supported our recovery. And the results are clear for all of us to see. 2.7 million people more in work today under a Conservative government than in 2010 under Labour. Did we hear that achievement being lauded in Liverpool last week? Of course not, because Corbyn's Labour Party has abandoned the agenda of working people, deserting the middle ground of British politics in favour of the socialist ideology of the metropolitan left-wing elite, leaving us, the Conservatives, as the true party of British working people.
Well, I mean, it's a very tendentious account of history, isn't it? You mentioned earlier on Liam Burns saying there's no money left. The reason there was no money left is because we bailed out the private sector banking system. We didn't have to do that. What the textbook tells you to do is to allow banks to collapse if they bust. That's what you do with car industries. That's what we've just done with the steel industry in South Wales. But the Labour government and the Bush administration in the US decided to bail out the private sector banking system. That's in absolute defiance of the Thatcherite textbook.
But the alternative, Martin, was that all the cash points in the Western world stopped working.
Well, indeed, I agree with you.
So don't you think they did the right
thing? They did the right thing, but don't try and tell me that the reason there's no money is because the bankers wrecked the economy. That's why there's no money, not because of the Labour government. The Labour government were responsible because they should have regulated the city. They had 13 years and they didn't do it. And that was because of John Smith's prawn cocktail offensive many years before, when Brian Gould was deputy leader of the party. And Brian Gould said to John Smith, we've got to discipline the City of London. And John Smith said to Brian Gould, no, Brian, I'm going to go and butter them up. I'm going to talk them around and I'm going to be nice to them. And Brian Gould, to his credit, said, well, if that's what you want to do, John, that's up to you, but I'm going back to New Zealand. And he went back to New Zealand to become a Chancellor of Auckland University. And that was the point at which Labour lost the plot and dropped the ball. Because they should have regulated the City of London when Blair came to power, and instead they didn't. And that's why we have the 2008 crash, that's why there's no money left, and that's what it's all about. And the right wing of the Labour Party that dominated it during that period dropped the ball.
I thought that was a joke. Liam Burns about where there's no money left.
I'd have taken it as a joke, but I'd like to say I agree with everything that Martin just said. That's exactly it. The banks caused the crash. They should have been regulated better, and they weren't. Yeah.
Philip Hammond then went on to talk about how wrong the Labour Party got it on the recession.
Of course, for much of his time as Chancellor, George Osborne faced Ed Balls across the dispatch box.
Remember Ed Balls? Yeah, I know you remember him from Saturday Night. I'm asking if you remember him in his more minor role as Shadow Chancellor. He told us back then that our policies would push the economy into recession. But he was wrong. Since 2010, Britain has grown faster than any other economy in the G7. He said we would never replace lost public sector jobs with new private sector jobs. But we did. Not one for one, but seven for one. And that's not all. We got our deficit down by nearly two-thirds. We cut the welfare bill. We've kept mortgage rates low, protecting millions of homeowners through difficult times. We've cut income tax for 30 million people and taken 4 million low-paid workers out of income tax altogether. I say, not bad for an economy that looked out for the count when we took it over in 2010, and a record of which this party can be justly proud.
I wonder if they're as justly proud as the cuts that they've made to local government, not just in Bristol, but up and down the country. And let's face it, some cities have suffered worse than Bristol has. I mean, Birmingham and Liverpool and Manchester are making worse redundancies than we got now some time ago. Is he as proud of that? We've got to save, what, £60 to £100 million by about 2020? Is he proud of that? Is he proud of the fact that we're struggling to pay for our social services, to care for people in their homes, to care for children in care, and we're struggling to fix the potholes in the roads?
You mentioned public sector job cuts there. What he's saying is that there's been seven private sector jobs for every one public sector job cut.
Yeah, but those private sector jobs aren't taking the meals on wheels round to the old folks, are they? So, you know. And by the way, before we leave this subject, because we were talking about the whole of that thing there, so my former ward mate, Naomi Rylett, I asked her, what do you think they'll talk to me about? And she gave me a list of five things. She said, well, I can think of four, and the other one might come up, might be Ed Balls on Strictly. I thought she was being silly, but there it was, Ed Balls on Strictly.
Well, I think actually that's why they do these things, so it gives people a kind of opportunity to talk about them in political speeches and make a kind of joke about it. But anyway, yeah. Martin, what do you make about that? Of that, I mean, there are some pretty hard facts there. The deficit down, things like 30 million people off income tax. He said, I think he said 30 million people, but I'm not sure if that's right. Correct. But anyhow,
well, let's get this clear. Initially, they said they were going to reduce the deficit to zero in the first term. And when you were trying,
you've already said that. No, why don't you address what he was saying which is one of which is things like keeping interest rates low. He's done a really good job on that. If you're paying a mortgage, that's really important.
No, but interest rates are low because it's been a deliberate policy to reduce them to zero. We're now on the zero interest rate band across the world, which is creating a massive bubble in the stock markets, which will crash.
Yes,
which
he hasn't mentioned at all. It's easier to pay your mortgage. Millions of people.
Many people don't pay mortgages because they rent, so it's irrelevant.
Many
to
people
them.
Do.
And don't forget the mortgage. The property market in this country is in a bubble, a classic Tory bubble. It is going to crash. Everything that they're doing, in fact, is borrowing from the future. And let's come back to the fundamental point. They were trying to reduce the deficit far too quickly. Ed Balls was right. If you go too quickly at this, you will crash the economy. And the economy started to falter. It was actually growing when they took it over, and then it stopped growing because they were going too far, too fast on the deficit. Then they took their foot off the brake and allowed the economy to grow a bit, and guess what? The deficit grew a bit as well. That's because these two things are linked. What's going to happen now is that the deficit is going to grow again because they're going to invest for the future, which is a wise decision, but it's completely the opposite of what they've been doing for the last 8 years. So when he says, oh, we've done all the deficit reduction now we're going to spend a bit, it's actually, we should have been spending a bit all along. Yeah. You got it wrong, then you got it right, and now you've got it right again, but you've got it wrong to begin with, and they've misjudged it all. And don't forget, it's all based on zero interest rates and quantitative easing, which means there's going to be a crash, a bigger crash than 2008. I want to hear what Hammond's policy is for that when he get there. When we get there and there's a crash, Philip, what's your policy going to be? Because we need to know.
Okay, well, we've also got a new Prime Minister, and part of her speech at the Tory conference was to do with national pride.
A country of decency, fairness and quiet resolve. And a successful country. Small in size, but large in stature, that with less than 1% of the world's population boasts more Nobel laureates than any country outside the United States, with three more added again just yesterday, two of whom worked here in this great city. A country...
That's Birmingham, folks.
A country that boasts three of the top 10 universities in the world, the world's leading financial capital, and institutions like the NHS and the BBC, whose reputations echo in some of the farthest corners of the globe. All possible because we are one united kingdom, England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. And I will always fight to preserve our proud historic union and will never let divisive nationalists drive us apart. Yet within our society today, we see division and unfairness all around, between a more prosperous older generation and a struggling younger generation, between the wealth of London and the rest of the country, but perhaps most of all, between the rich, the successful and the powerful and their fellow citizens. Now, don't get me wrong. We applaud success. We want people to get on. But we also value something else, the spirit of citizenship. That spirit that means you respect the bonds and obligations that make our society work, that means a commitment to the men and women who live around you, who work for you, who buy the goods and services you sell. That spirit that means recognising the social contract that says you train up local young people before you take on cheap labour from overseas. That spirit that means you do as others do and pay your fair share of tax. But today... But today, too many people in positions of power behave as though they have more in common with international elites than with the people down the road, the people they employ, the people they pass on the street. But if you believe you're a citizen of the world, you're a citizen of nowhere. You don't understand what the very word citizenship means. So if you're a boss who earns a fortune but doesn't look after your staff, an international company that treats tax laws as an optional extra, a household name that refuses to work with the authorities even to fight terrorism, a director who takes out massive dividends while knowing that the company pension is about to go bust. I'm putting you on warning. This can't go on anymore. A change has got to come, and this party is going to make it.
This can't go on anymore. Okay, they've been in power for 6 years. How come it's gone on for 6 years? It's a kind of kinder, gentler sounding conservatism, kinder, gentler sounding capitalism. But it strikes me that whenever there's a new leader of the Conservative Party, we do tend to get this kind of rhetoric, don't we? Does anybody, you know, older people, rather than younger people, rather, would remember Margaret Thatcher quoting Francis of Assisi when she first came to power in 1979? So it's not a new thing. So the question then is, does this actually happen in practice? David Cameron came to power, the great friend of the NHS. What's happened to the NHS? We all know. So, let's see how it pans out. She's talking about putting workers on boards, as something the Germans did, gosh, I don't know, back in the 1960s or 70s or something?
40s,
was it?
Yeah.
Even better.
One thing she was talking about there is tax avoidance, yeah. but the Independent and various other papers printed back in July this year, Theresa May's husband's a senior executive at a $1.4 trillion investment fund that profits from tax-avoiding companies. Amazon and Starbucks are mentioned in his speech, but... in a relatively unknown investment fund where Theresa May's husband, Philip, works as a senior executive. He's one of the world's largest and most powerful financial institutions. Controls $1.4 trillion in assets. Its portfolio also includes $20 billion of shares in Amazon and Starbucks. So maybe she should have a word with Philip, her husband, Martin.
Well, maybe she should, or maybe she'd have a word with Ed Miliband, who tweeted this week saying that this all sounds like Marxist anti-business rhetoric from him, because of course what she's doing is she's stealing the rhetoric of Ed Miliband and of Corbyn. But of course it doesn't really come quite the same from somebody whose husband's a top investment banker, does
it? I mean, he's an interesting chap, this Theresa May's husband, Philip May. I don't see a lot of him. He avoids the spotlight totally, but he couldn't really totally avoid things at the conference this week. And Michael Crick, former Newsnight political correspondent, now on Channel 4 News, along with a few other people, managed to track him down.
Tory-backed bencher Richard Drax is cock-a-hoop at the decline of the ancien regime.
And this is so refreshing now to have Mrs. May in charge and at last looking in the direction I came into the House of Commons to pursue. And she's doing it in a very calm and sensible way, and I'm right behind her.
It does seem like nearly everything that Cameron and Osborne stood for is being quietly ditched.
No comment.
Then who did we spot but Mr. Theresa May, today named as the fourth most influential right-winger in Britain.
I think that's highly unlikely, Michael, I have to say.
Well, apparently you are a big influence on the Prime Minister for some reason.
Well, Prime Minister, I have met...
Does she run her speeches by you?
The Prime Minister runs her speeches by her official advisers, Michael.
And you one of those?
I don't think so.
Is this a return to Thatcherism that we're seeing under your watch?
I have absolutely no comments about policy, Michael. You should know better than that by now. We've known each other actually, it's interesting. I think we've known each other for 40 years, something like that.
It does seem to me that everything that Cameron and Osborne stood for is now being ditched.
I think questions like that, Michael, you're going to have to ask the Prime Minister.
All you have to do is deny it.
It's nothing to do with me, Mike.
Well, a couple of things about that interesting little encounter. One is where Michael Crick has obviously come from the same school or something as Philip May, old school Thai buddies. But the other thing is that Philip May seems to have a laugh, more like a metronome than a laugh. Very strange sounding chap. But Martin, what about this close relationship with someone who's a major executive at this enormous $1.4 trillion in assets firm that's actually got massive investments in these big tax dodging companies? And Theresa May Zed stood up saying we're going to do something about it.
It's like David Cameron's father, who made his millions pioneering tax avoidance, and they can bloviate about all of this because the Labour Party put this on the agenda and others, and the Tories now feel that they have to say something about it. But the problem for them is that it's very hard for people in glass houses to throw stones. They're all very vulnerable. When we look into their tax affairs, we find that they are basically all of them on the rob.
Okay, let's go back to Theresa May, though, and she also, as Mark was hinting at earlier on, was talking about having workers and actually consumers as well on boards of companies, which would be quite amazing.
Often the people who are supposed to hold big business accountable are drawn from the same narrow social and professional circles as the executive team, and too often the scrutiny they provide is not good enough. A change has got to come. So later this year we will publish our plans to have not just consumers represented on company boards, but workers as well. Because we are the party of workers, of those who put in the effort, those who contribute and give of their best. That's why we announced on Saturday that we're going to review our laws to make sure that in our modern and flexible economy, people are properly protected at work. That's right. Workers' rights. Not under threat from a Conservative government. Workers' rights protected and enhanced by a Conservative government. And let me say something about tax. We're all Conservatives here. We all believe in a low-tax economy. But we also know that tax is the price we pay for living in a civilised society. Nobody, no individual tycoon and no single business, however rich, has succeeded on their own.
Their goods are transported by road, their workers are educated in schools, their customers are part of sophisticated networks taking in the private sector, the public sector and charities. We've all played a part in that success. So it doesn't matter to me who you are. If you're a tax dodger, we're coming after you. If you're an accountant, financial advisor, or a middleman who helps people to avoid what they owe to society, we're coming after you too.
Well, isn't that enlightening? I mean, the idea of workers on and consumers on boards is a good one. It's a question. I mean, there's going to be a lot of detail to come out. So, how does that work? Is there a secret ballot amongst everybody that works in the organisation? Or is it done differently to that? We will need to know, won't we? I think she must have scared half the people in that room to death. Really, I mean, talking about workers' rights, they well, I'd just love to have seen their faces, quite frankly.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting rhetorical demarche that she's making there. Incidentally, we're talking about workers on boards. The workers are put on boards called Mitbestimmung, and Montan Mitbestimmung was the most extreme version of it in Germany, and it was actually enforced in the British controlled zone of Germany. They forced the big companies to have workers on their boards. They also strengthened the trade union movement, the DGB in Germany.
It was the British
Army and the Labour government, and they insisted that they were going to discipline Krupp and Tyson and all these other big companies by forcing them to have workers on the board. Mm. And of course, it actually worked really well for the Germans, because having the workers on the board meant that the companies did have a long-term investment strategy. They couldn't just get rid of people. They have works councils in Germany which have to be informed of anything that's going on. And eventually, they were given one third of the board in most of the companies. Although in actual fact the German unions were pushing for 50-50, they wanted to have what they called Montan Mitbestimmung, which was, you know, co-determination. You get half the board and we get the other half. The British didn't quite go that far. They sort of backed off from that. But of course, in Britain itself, none of this was implemented. None of it. And of course, that's why German industry has outperformed British industry over the period since the Second World War. But now they're talking about it. But it's now 2016. We're a long way behind on this, aren't we?
Well, we leave the for the time being. We have some more after the news from the Conservative Party conference. Have a listen to, for example, a bit of Boris Johnson and the International Development Secretary, who's our local MP just south of here, Liam Fox. But that we also had a kind of, I suppose, a State of the Union address, it used to be called, but I think Martin's borrowed our name, because we online called the second half of this show the State of the City Reports, and Marvin now does his State of the City address, as George Ferguson did before him. So let's listen to a clip from that now. And Marvin is rather engaged with the whole idea of Brexit, and he's worried how it might affect the city. So let's have a listen to that now. That was up at the Wheels Memorial Building, I believe, just earlier this week.
One of the unusual impacts of Brexit could be that it works against our city and other cities' interests. You see, the whole Brexit argument was built on the idea of empowering national government and was totally silent on regional and city government. Cities need open borders in a post-national world, and yet Brexit sets national government as another hoop for us to jump through. In that sense, ironically, Brexit does not liberate, it centralises power, moving sovereignty away from the local level into national government hands. I've written to David Davis, and with the core cities, we will do our best to shape Brexit to minimise the harm it could do to our development, and we will take that message to government. Now, a big part of our international reach is our cultural offer. Now, we're rightly proud of our cultural offer in the city. Our cultural impact exceeds our expenditure, and Bristol has a reputation that brings Bristol to the city. Our initial commitment to launch a bid to become a European capital of culture has been undermined by the Brexit vote. Nevertheless, we can continue to prioritise our cultural offer, but this must be an offer that is inclusive, one that doesn't only celebrate the city centre. In sport, Bristol has punched below its weight, and I'm determined to increase activity, participation, access and elite sport in the city. And I can share tonight that we are in discussions to bring powerboat racing back to the city's docks.
Well, that's one of the only real big announcements in his State of the City speech. Mark Brain, what did you make of it?
Well, the powerboats.
No, the speech generally, and what we heard there about Brexit.
Didn't hear his entirety,
he was saying one thing there that really puzzled me, was open borders are really necessary in a post-national world. Well, what is a post-national world? I don't know if that's at all clear. I mean, the nation states have suddenly been divided or dissolved.
Well, the nation states were coming together to the European Union, and then there was a thing called Brexit, and now we're moving in the opposite direction.
So it doesn't sound like Marvin is kind of on board at all with the whole Brexit.
No, thing. I think what he's saying here is that it's an issue for Bristol, because as we're trying to travel into this, if you like, post-national world, as he calls it, then if you're moving off the other direction, it starts to bring up barriers. And we were talking about bank regulation earlier. Unless countries come together, that doesn't happen, because the banks just move from one country to another. We were talking earlier about
Well, we've got another clip, and this is from Marvin now, which is a short one, where he talks a bit about his five-year plan for the city.
Yeah. Now, I focus tonight on the state of the city, not the state of the city council. But I need to share with you that we, as a city council, have inherited huge financial pressures. The budget for the city council is challenging, and we are facing decisions now to make in-year savings of around £33 million, and facing a budget gap of at least £90 million by March 2022. Inevitably, the decisions we have to make to set a legal budget will be painful for the city and for our partners. But we have a financial envelope imposed on us by central government that we have to operate within.
And he goes on to announce this review you were talking about earlier, actually, Mark. Martin Summers, what do you make of this? Because it does seem as if they're very reluctantly having to go along exactly with what the government is saying, basically, and cutting massively back on public services, even though at the same time we're seeing a turnaround at Westminster and saying, OK, well, that's enough of austerity.
Yeah, it's an austerity for us, but not for them, eh? Well, the fact is that
this time
we've had a big fuss about whether we're going to have a mayor and who it should be, but the Tories have made a big deal about devolving power. But when it comes to it, in actual fact, the decisions have already been taken by the Treasury. And that this is all a big fraud in many cases. You could argue that local government is in fact a fraud because it doesn't actually have any power.
Just a final quick word, sorry, but we must mention this. Tory Minister Sajid Javid grants fracking rights after receiving funds from pro-fracking interests like ExxonMobil. And that is on Thomas Pride blog. And you can look any of these stories up, including Marvin's speech, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. For the Murdoch News, at 6 o'clock's on now. Thanks very much to Labour Councillor for Hartcliffe and with you with Mark Brain. Very interesting, Mark. After the news, the US withdraws cooperation from the Russians after so-called ceasefire violations in Syria.
Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.